Do you ever feel like you're late to crypto? Maybe FOMO kicks in, and when prices go up, you think you don't have enough, or you wish you got in sooner? Well, Santiago, today's guest, says that right now, he feels like he's earlier in crypto now versus how he felt when he first entered the space back in 2012. It's all about perspective and understanding how secular trends work. In today's episode, we compare the trends of blockchain to that of the internet in the early 90s and 2000s. And Santiago, who started as an investment banker at JP Morgan and then became a partner at Parify Capital, shares his insights on investing in the cycle, as well as the specific use cases and narratives that he feels will take crypto to the masses. This was a fun one. Welcome to Milk Road Radio, the easiest path to get smarter about crypto. I'm Kyle Reedhead, your host for today's show, and we believe that on-chain is the next online. This is the opportunity, and we're here to help you capitalize on it. Before we get into the episode, I just want to announce we are hiring. We filled a bunch of our positions just recently, but we are still on the lookout for a social media wizard, someone who absolutely loves crypto and lives on Twitter and other social platforms. If that's you, check out the careers link in the show notes below and make sure to apply immediately. By the way, a quick warning, just want to let you know that I recorded this episode from the mic from my webcam by accident, not my actual mic. So bear with me on the audio quality. Thankfully, Santi does most of the talking, so it's not that big of a deal. But just want to let you know, you just got to bear with me for this one episode, and then we'll be good to go moving forward. Thanks, friends. Santi, welcome to Milk Road Radio. It's good to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Kyle. I really like the name and the logo. It's pretty cool. It just brings me back to like this warm, like childhood moment of like drinking milk at night with cookies. Hopefully this episode will evoke that level of, we'll be, I think, productive and successful if we evoke that.
Absolutely. We're trying to find more ways to make milk more synonymous with crypto. And I don't know why, but that's just what we're going with. And
some people talk about like slurping alpha, like slurping, you
know, or like milky alpha. Milky alpha. Anyway, Santi, I've been listening to you for a long time on Empire, which is a great, great podcast for those that are listening as well. And you do a great job at just sort of like explaining your thesis around the space, around what you're doing. Talk a lot about like even psychology of investing stuff, which I really appreciate and love that. But I'm just curious, I don't think you've ever really shared your background too much on that podcast, or maybe I missed that episode. And I'm sure there's many listeners here that haven't heard you previously. So why don't you just start off with just a quick like background of what got you into crypto and walk us through a bit of a story there.
Yeah, I'll be brief and cut me off. Obviously, first discovered the Bitcoin white paper in 2012 was like the first interaction with it. My background's in game theory, so to me that was like purely from an academic perspective, I'm like, oh wow, like we can do stuff without trusting, like we've solved a big problem, which is the Byzantium Standard problem. People should go look it up. It's fascinating. Emailed it to my professors. They're like, oh, this is a scam. I've heard about it. Silk Road. And I've learned time and time again, anytime you get a very strong visceral reaction from people in academia or people in high status, like pay attention to that. Most of the time that's where disruption happens. And to me, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to keep learning about this because this is pretty cool. I grew up in an emerging country in Mexico. And so this idea, I think like whenever you travel, like you're in Brazil now, sorry to have doxed. When you take finance and export it, like, and you try to do it internationally, it absolutely breaks. And it's like, as an investor, my thesis was like constantly asking questions, like there has to be a better way to sending money cross border. And that was like juxtaposed with like your day-to-day interaction. Are you using Amazon? Seamless. You're streaming Netflix. Like the internet is just amazing. And all of a sudden you're like, why hasn't particular pockets of this world not modernized? And there's a very specific reason why. And I think that's like, if you go in your crypto journey, and I did, you start understanding why that is the case. It obviously helped that I did investment banking. I was doing like, you know, transactions in like tech and in fintech. And so you kind of like really appreciate how broken it is. And then like was investing where it really clicked, other than Bitcoin, like in 2012, was when Ethereum launched. I was at a fund where we were a venture fund. We were investing in open source software. And this was in a time where like most investors didn't appreciate that you could make money investing in open source. Like inherently, it's like paradoxical. It's like it's open, it's free. Anyone can copy the code. How are you going to make money? Like where's the moat? And then, you know, Red Hat got acquired by IBM. And everyone was like, oh, wow, you can actually make a lot of money. And Ethereum was that, right? And just generally like applying a lot of the stuff of Bitcoin. And I discovered it early and I was like, okay, this could with some degree of probability really transform how we think about open source and fixing a lot of the issues that traditional open source development has, primarily like where value accrues and how you compensate contributors in an open source system without crypto, without tokenization becomes incredibly difficult. It needs to be subsidized in some way. And I think crypto, as I think about it, just to kind of wrap all of this up, is if there's one key takeaway for me and what keeps me really interested in this game is crypto for the first time kind of ever allows us to tokenize, create digital scarcity, but also like map out and create a more equitable remuneration for contributors in these open source systems. Smart people and technology generally gravitates to open source systems. And now you have the ability to tokenize and map out contributions and output and reward these contributors in an equitable manner. That kind of flips the whole model of the internet in its head and opens up a whole new kind of chapter of the internet. It's not that crypto replaces the internet. It actually enhances it by orders of magnitude. And I don't think people are really prepared for that outcome. But we're talking about, like, when I got started, I used to have a whiteboard and I would be like, okay, like, I think Bitcoin was like at $60 at the time or $100. It was like, I forget what that was. It was like, I guess we can talk about like 21 billion times 60, couple billion, 100 billion.
In market cap. Yeah.
In market cap. You're like, God, if this ever reaches like, you know, like, No. I mean, it was 21 million total Bitcoin. Like the FTV of Bitcoin network at the time was like nothing. I mean, it was a couple billion. And you're like, God, if it reaches like 200 billion, 500 billion, it'd be like, it was surreal. And now we're like at 2.5 trillion. It's been kind of crazy. What I'm trying to impress on people is I think updating that and like sometimes it's useful to like expand your horizon and say, okay, how big can this really get? Like for me, something like collectively smart contracting, generalized platforms can be way larger than a digital gold. Vastly, vastly larger. Let me ask you a question. Like, okay, we comp Bitcoin to gold, which is 9 trillion. All right. So, you know, you come up with a number of Bitcoin.
It's a little higher now. It's at all-time highs.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, true. Right. Exactly. But it's like 10 trillion, 11 trillion or so with inflation or whatever. And then the question is like, well, how big is the internet?
Well, I think it's way bigger, of course.
Exactly. That's what's really exciting now.
Two questions here, actually. So when you in 2012, you learned about Bitcoin. Did you get it right away? Did you and then invest in it and like hold that? Or like how did that go through these wild cycles? And then when ETH came along, did you see right away like, oh, this is moving from, I mean, Bitcoin wasn't called digital gold back in those days. Right. But did you see automatically like, oh, what this Ethereum thing is doing is open this up to the entire internet? Or did it take a while to like?
It always takes a while. Figure it out. Yeah. It always takes a while. It always really does in the sense of like, how big can it get? Bitcoin was interesting. I comped it to the global remittance flows because at the time, you know, I bought a bunch of Bitcoin and I was in New York. So I actually went to Soho Center. Felt like a direct trade. Really sketchy. Took me a while to figure it out. Bought a couple of Bitcoin and sent it to people in Mexico and said, if they can actually retrieve it, if like N out of 10, which is a majority, can actually convert it. Like I'm dollars by Bitcoin. They convert it to local currency and the commission there is negligible and almost instantaneous. Then this can actually displace a Western Union, which is charging 5-8% and shouldn't exist. And actually, I've made it my life. At that point, I made it my life's purpose to like blow up this type of business. I hate it. I absolutely hate it because the people that need it the most are the ones that get screwed over by the traditional system. Anyways, I said, that feels to me like a pretty big use case. It's the number one or number two source of income for Mexican families. Remittance flows are also really important, like Singapore to Indonesia, Philippines, some of these places, right? And so it's a really big market. And so as a payments rail, I felt that Bitcoin was pretty compelling after that, like episode, after that, like hypothesis and it working out. But still, I mean, you don't like, it's kind of surreal. Like we have an ETF now. It's like covered constantly. It's a ticker in Bloomberg. No, you didn't. No, it's wild. Ethereum, it took me a while, right? It's so abstract. Yeah. And my mind just works in a different way. Like, I don't know. I didn't see it immediately. As an investor, I think you take certain bets and you size them with a certain degree of probability. The probability is quite low. I mean, just think about this for a second. You meet Vitalik. He comes from Bitcoin Magazine. There were other attempts of what Ethereum is trying to do. Golem, Madesafe, and a bunch of others, I believe, that predated Ethereum. With people that probably had more like deep cryptographic technical experience, but in comes Vitalik and says, I want to build a world supercomputer. He looks at you straight in the eye. He's 18. He just comes from Bitcoin Magazine. What do you do?
You laugh, probably.
Do you give him $1 million?
I wouldn't.
Exactly. And there were some elements that I think made it far more interesting as Ethereum developed. I think you had Gavin Wood, you had like, it was not just Vitalik, I do appreciate. So like from that perspective, you know, you get more conviction. But I think I would be lying to myself if I told you that it was obvious out of the get-go. I felt that there, it was really interesting, this thesis of like, let's generalize this piece of technology and like smart contracts were like, it was something that I was kind of clicked. How big, how fast? Definitely not. And then you had the ICO kind of capital formation machine that like, I think was in large part what has made Ethereum, Ethereum today. You know, like, how do you make a community? We make a bunch of people rich that want to make, that have a vested interest in building. And, you know, the ICOs were like, just Ethereum had a lot of success with ICOs, just being as the de facto currency to fund this, these things. As a first kind of proof point of how you could use a smart contract, right? Send money in, we'll distribute you other tokens. Like that was like very basic, kind of the probably the earliest DeFi kind of use case, right? But it wasn't as obvious back then. I hedged my Bitcoin. I mean, it was also at a time where like a lot of the Bitcoin miners were like, there's this disagreement in the Bitcoin community. And I felt kind of a bit disillusioned. I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to punt this. I'm going to swap like 20% of my stack and put it in Ethereum, and not just Ethereum, but Golems and Madesaves and a bunch of other stuff. You kind of have to, right? You size these things with a certain degree of probability. Like if you can invest in multiple players, even today, the industry being so early, like why wouldn't you, right? Why would you just bet on one horse? It's kind of stupid.
I think now people, anytime you look back, especially when crypto is so cyclical, you look back and like, oh, that was so easy to trade that, right? Like if you bought that in 2017 or you bought it in 2020, even with ETH, you're like, oh, it was so easy. But it's like, if you weren't in that moment, you don't realize how much doubt and how much like FUD was going around. It's kind of like Solana last year, right?
Yeah.
So many people missed that trade early on because there was so much FUD. And now it's like, well, that was so obvious.
I'll tell you two things on this point, because I think it's fascinating. One, most people are full of shit when they say it's so obvious. Yeah. It's not. It never is. The reason is my best investments have been the most uncomfortable. At the moment I made the investment, the most highly uncomfortable. And this is not like me going like 10x leverage. I've never used leverage for the most part. You have some strong feeling about the founder, the type of person that they are, but it's never obvious. If it's really obvious, it's arbed out by virtue. It's like if it's obvious and it's obvious for 100 other people, the valuation is going to be really high. Like you're not getting into the ground level. You're not buying DeFi at 5 million market cap. You're buying it at 50. Okay. Very big difference. The second component is this point around 5 to 50. In crypto, historically, you've had like time to scale into a trade. Solana. The problem though is the mind just gets it at you, right? It's like, oh God. How many times have you asked the question, tell me your crypto journey? And how many times does someone say, I discovered Bitcoin super early, but invested 5 years later?
And how many times that's why I asked. That's exactly why I asked you, because almost always that happens.
Exactly. And what is that? What that's a soft way of saying I didn't put money in it. And I'm stupid and I regret it. And you know that they regret it. And I think it's just important to like zoom out and say, invert and say, how many more years do you have as an investor? You look like you're in your 30s, 20, whatever. You have at least 30, 40 more years to invest. Do you think we're early in crypto? Like you walk around where you are. How many people do you actually think are investing in this asset class? We just got an ETF approved. Are you trying to time every cycle? I'm trying to invest in the next 30, 40 years. And compound. I want to perfect my process. I want to focus. I know I'm not going to catch them all. And so is that a way of coping that I didn't catch like the latest fad at like 1 million market cap or the latest meme coin that just launched or runes? No. Partially, maybe it's a cope. But I also like you have to stay focused. Like this industry has grown a ton where it's impossible to keep track of every sector, every opportunity. Yeah, AI, Deepin, memes, different ecosystems. You're not going to catch them all, right? I think you need to just like have conviction around it pays to do the work. It pays to have a thesis. It also is useful to be flexible, but also scaling in like DeFi, for instance. If you map out like you could have looked at Maker and said, okay, there's something here. Maybe you didn't catch DeFi that early on. Maybe you waited until Compound launched a liquidity mining program, blew everyone away. It's like, wow, like you can earn yield and this is great, like stable coins. You then had another 6 to 9 months to scale into that trade in size. Now, there's some people that were just very like, I missed it and were like, I'm not going to touch this. I'm late to the trade. I'm late to the train. I'm like, what are you talking about? Are you really? You're like, or like Solana right now, right? Publicly, I've been very vocal about Solana. And I've said, there's no reason why Solana shouldn't flip Ethereum. That's just my view. That's my thesis. I've done more work. I continue to do more work. There are reasons why that could be validated. There are reasons why that might be invalidated. And I'm focusing my attention on like the recent outage in Solana. Well, I'm paying attention to that. Like, what are the devs doing? How's this happening? How's FireDance going to, you know, there are clearly certain things that Solana hasn't figured out at all yet. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why it trades at a discount. But if you didn't catch Solana at 8, you could have caught it at 20, 60, 100, 150, 200. Now it's at 150 or 130. If you're constantly focusing on that price movement, it would be way more useful to go back to the drawing board and say, okay, why is Solana even worth what it is today? And why is Ethereum worth what it is? And why are they different? Why is Solana fundamentally better or worse than Ethereum? And I think like asking those very basic questions is probably better use of time than like, you know, eating yourself up for like not catching it, not catching it at the absolute bottom. You know what I mean? It's like, well, it's impossible.
We're going to get into your thoughts around Solana versus ETH, as well as a bunch more, actually, I think later on. So let's pull back a little bit first. And I want to talk about, well, a few things, actually. One thing you talk about a lot, and you've touched on it a bit here, is the psychological impacts of investing. I feel like the psychology of investing is probably like 80% investing and 20% doing your research. I don't know if those numbers are actually accurate. But the thing I've learned over the years of investing, and especially in crypto, is how important it is to just like manage your mindset and like understand your plan and your framework and your strategy. And so two things, I mean, one, if you want to go on a rant about the psychology side, feel free to do so. I've heard you do it before. So I think you'll, you know, people are going to really like that. The second thing I just want to talk about is sort of just a general framework. Obviously you've been in the space since 2012, investing in it. What is that? 12 years, which is wild actually. And so you've seen these crazy cycles. You said already, you know, we're still early. Talk to me a little bit about how you play this stuff. Is it just always long-term? Are you trying to take profits somewhere at the top somewhere? Like, just walk me through how you think about it.
Look, there's always an relative opportunity cost to things. And so naturally, yes, I'm not of the mind that you should hold these things indefinitely. There's always an opportunity cost. A couple things, right, in my journey. If you can change your life, change your life. Change your life. Insulate your lifestyle. That has been the biggest upgrade that I've done. And someone said it because I round tripped like three cycles or two and a half. And then someone came to me and said, insulate your life. And I was like, no, I don't want to take money out of crypto. I think we're still early. It's like, yes, we're still early. But like, first of all, if you believe you're that early, it doesn't really matter because what you take out, like, you know what I mean? You'll still be wildly successful, but optimize for minimizing distractions. Because when you insulate your life, you don't have to think about like the mundane stuff, then you can really focus. And that's something that I've like really, and it touches on both elements, right? Like at some point you take profit. At some point, there's like exuberance to things. There's irrationality to what the way things are trading. I think you have to constantly question and re-underwrite your thesis, right? And it's hard. Look, I mean, I've done an episode about my mistakes. Like, arguably would have been more successful if I didn't touch my ETH that I bought, very early on. How do you define success is the other question. What is success? And part of what I think of success now is going through these motions of developing a framework, developing a process. Because, you know, the outcome could be wildly successful. Say you made $1 billion on ETH. I probably could have, actually, if I just held the bag, but I didn't.
Right.
Like, it's just wild to think about that. And over time in my career, I've looked at that and like, I've become depressed. I've thought of myself as a failure as an investor. But at some point you realize, well, it's a bit difficult in a parallel universe. Maybe I would have used that money to invest in other things that I love that I think the world just doesn't allocate resources to, like research and whatever. But, you know, I can still do that today. Different outcome. But I like the fact that, you know, for whatever reason that happened, and I like the process, right? And you learn through the process. And, you know, I think as an investor, you can be extremely right about the future. And maybe it takes one good investment. Like, you were right about Ethereum. You're right about the future. But trying to replicate that is actually probably hard if you don't have a process. And I didn't have a process going into crypto. I was investing, but crypto is just a different animal. Like, it's liquid, it's venture, and it's liquid. And so it requires like certain motions. Like, other people have been way more successful than I have. For me, it's just taking this idea that how do you manage risk, right? It's the hardest thing to do because you're investing in something that is super inherently long-term, but you have a market that is 24/7, 365. And to your point, managing those emotions and managing that risk is very difficult. And I think it goes back to a core element in my process, which is there's two things, right? There's two types of errors, one of process and one of outcome. In investing, you're going to make a ton of mistakes of outcome. You can't control many things. You can't tell me, like, I can't tell you what the price is going to be tomorrow, much less I have a certain degree of probability the long term, you know, certain things I think are going to be much larger than what they are now based on some market assumption and whatever, usage and whatnot. But it's very difficult. The outcome is you can't control it. The worst you can do is think that you can control the outcome and then just do crazy stuff like leverage and whatnot and blow up. But I think what you can always do is perfect your process. If you made a mistake, you can look back and say, okay, diagnose those errors of process and perfect your process. Why? Because you have 30 more years ahead of you. And you can compound that. You can perfect your process, compound your capital. I'm not trying to time this cycle perfectly. I am trying to like protect my principal. And I'm looking out for really smart people. I'm also constantly re-underwriting my thesis. So like, hey, well, I have more certainty that Solana, like I see a cleaner line of path for Solana supporting a bunch of applications across DeFi, AI, and a bunch of others. I don't necessarily see that in the scalability roadmap of Ethereum. And it's been frustrating. I'm still investing in Ethereum. I'm still investing in these L2s. I think they're worthwhile experiments. The question and the nuance is in what proportion, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So you say the word cycles, which makes me believe you think we're in another cycle.
We're always in a cycle, right?
We're always in a cycle, true. But do you think that we are in a similar cycle to what we've been in previously? These sort of four-year cycles that we've had, there's been, what, three of them since you've been in the space at least. Maybe we're in our fourth. There's this huge debate with everyone, and everyone seems to be mixed. Some are like, it's an accelerated cycle. Some are like, this isn't a cycle anymore. Mm-hmm. There's a super cycle. There's all these things, which is generally when you talk about, oh, I'm going to take some profits and stuff. I'm going to try and do it at the top of the cycle. What are you thinking in terms of like where we're at right now of market structure, whether it's a cycle or not? And by cycle, I mean like the typical crypto cycle. Like, what is your analysis on that?
It's a very complex question. I think I'll offer people practical stuff. To your point around psychology, if investing at the micro level, everyone is investing in it. It's a very psychological sport. Inherently, markets are very psychological. Therefore, they're prone to excess, extremes, right? Both on kind of like everyone seeing kind of the different stages of the market cycle, despair of to euphoria, and then, you know, disillusionment and whatnot. That always plays out. It always has in every market. So I think it's just important to like recognize and honor history. Their super cycle does not exist. There's always volatility. It's an asset class that is going through constant price discovery. We could be back Bitcoin at 40K. And I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think anyone will be. People might be sad, but we could be there. It's just very volatile. Concretely, I am of the mind that probabilistically we are earlier than in the early mid phase of a cycle, not so much towards the end. I feel good about the rest of the year. The things I'm looking at is we just had the ETF approval. We're probably going to see an ETH ETF by the end of the year. And I think that was pretty useful, instrumental. Get more people. And the reason I say that is because, you know, Bitcoin is very different than the rest of crypto, I think. And I think allocators, the type of allocator that is perhaps buying into the Bitcoin ETF is using it as a proxy. But I think something like Ethereum probably captures more mindshare amongst people that are looking to invest in technology. Whereas Bitcoin, that people might be investing in Bitcoin for a variety of reasons. Like, it's really the barometer of risk, right? It doesn't, over the weekend, like this is 24/7, 365. So crypto has become a really good proxy for vol, for risk that people are paying attention to. But I think the ETF for Ethereum likely happens this year. And I think that sustains, you know, part of the cycle. And then the interest also, it is a flows game, right? That's something that I've appreciated more and more. Like, certainly like November of 2021, like rates are going up for the first time ever in my investing career. This is the first cycle that I'm investing through, you know, non-zero interest rates. And I was very mindful going into that. Like, it's just sort of a new normal, a new paradigm for me. I've never gone through that. So it is a learning curve. Understanding. And, you know, you also hear people like Stan Druckenmiller, who's been investing way longer than I have, way more successful, and say, this is pretty difficult environment to invest in. I asked this question in a panel. I was at like in London at a DAS, Digital Asset Summit, mostly institutions. And then I was at Token 2049 in Dubai. I asked the question in both panels, who would have predicted, who on the timeline predicted that we would have all-time highs and rates unchanged at 5.5? Who actually was saying that? And it's like,
no one.
Maybe there's one or two people who were saying that, but who believed it with conviction, like threw in? And the answer is like very little people. Like, it's very challenging. So I'm very cognizant of that. Concretely, again, offering just kind of more tips. Like, you always kind of, things that I look at, like, are funding rates. You know, how much leverage is in the system? How heated is a particular narrative? You look at open interest and funding rates across different exchange venues, and generally, like, you can always expect really like a lot of volatility, even in a bull market regime. You have 10-20% drawdowns. Altcoins are down 40-60%, 70% since, you know, 2 months ago. Does that invalidate the bull market thesis? No, I just think it's part of like consolidation. And, you know, there's always kind of a early investors take profit, and then the relative opportunity cost, people kind of migrate more into Bitcoin, and then more flows come into the space. Typically they go into Bitcoin, and then, you know, they go into other stuff. I think that's generally true still. I guess the last thing I'll say, maybe this opens up for subsequent questions, is like, I'm quite excited. Market psychology cycles are always a thing, always going to happen. There's always going to be like bull, bear market, whatever, trough, you know, peak. The internet offers really useful analogies, because kind of like the dot-com crash, true disillusionment, 2001, people were skeptical of the internet. It's like, why do you need this? I think crypto, email came around, made the internet like what it is today. Like, it really like brought home what the internet meant for people. I think crypto is finally entering that stage. We've been like investing in infrastructure for the last 12 years. And I think,
what's the use case? What's exactly the email to crypto?
I think it's deepened.
Interesting. Okay.
Look, when you're buying a data plan and it's Helium, you don't care it's crypto powered. You just say, okay, I'm comparing it to AT&T. It's like half the price. And I'm also like, or less, it's like you're paying for itself. Maybe it doesn't pay for, it's not sustainable. It's free. Like step in, you know, walking and then getting paid $40 to walk the lines. That's like not sustainable, but it offers like something really interesting, which is people start using this stuff. They don't appreciate it, but it's a great onboarding mechanism. And I think DeepIn just makes crypto very relatable. You're from Canada, or, you know, you live in Europe. Asking someone to buy Bitcoin as a macro hedge clearly turned out to be incorrect, or as a hedge against what? Or, I mean, it's an incredibly volatile instrument. Anyways, you could argue stable coins are that email moment, right? It just needs the unlock of like regulatory clarity. And, you know, you have the stablecoin bill, it's coming through Mika in Europe and a bunch of other places. Like, the ETF certainly de-risks and makes crypto like a legitimate asset class. And so maybe, I think like I go back and forth whether it's a stablecoin, because I think payments, back to my initial opening of like why I became interested in this, like payments are the first thing that you discover crypto. You're like, holy shit, like, stablecoins are just amazing. Like, people want to hold a more stable thing than their local shitcoin, fiat.
I was going to say stablecoins was my thought, which I was like, you said DeepIn. I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe it's stablecoins is the email version to the internet, but I don't know. Do you think that either of these could be the thing that brings in, and already sort of are, at least on the stablecoin side, bring in millions, but let's say tens, hundreds of millions. Do you think that we're even there? That's one of the things where like people keep talking about this super cycle. And I was like, I don't think we're getting to mainstream adoption yet. We're still got to like, be years away, I think.
I think the thinking is this a secular trend? Absolutely. The internet like had success in spite of geopolitical tensions, multiple wars in Iraq and other places, moments of high interest rates. Like, the question is like, is this technology fundamentally better? Is there a reason for normal people to use it? Is it like 10x better? People are inherently lazy. They don't want to change their status quo. They might complain, but they're not going to change it. The reason why I like at a global scale DeepIn is that it makes it very relatable across not just consumer, but just investing in a company. Like, I spent a lot of time with the founder in Dubai, and they are like mapping out and creating like this local network, like RTK network. Like, basically GPS is very unreliable. So you have these antennas that have like a 40 mile diameter that covers like high density or even rural areas. So it's applicable, and it's actually getting a lot of traction from industry, because they go to a convention, like ag convention, a bunch of farmers there, and they're trying to use drones. Good luck trying to use drones with GPS. GPS is like, when you're talking about like small parcels of land, mapping out that technology and having like people talk about AI and like a, you know, the smart John Deere tractor, like mowing and farming and whatever irrigation technology. I'm like, yeah, but you need like really precise location data, and GPS is not going to cut it. There's like Web2 companies that have tried to get this type of scale, and they have, like, there's big multi-billion dollar companies that have provide these type of antenna and services, like, and that provide precise range, but they haven't covered most of the world. This company is like a year old, and they've been able to bootstrap and go to market and like map out an incredible surface area of the world in the same way that you see Hive Mapper tracking and mapping out a bunch of roads, and Helium, like a lot of people just do it yourself kind of people, like buy the equipment because they can earn the rewards. Like, it basically, in a similar manner, that like software as a service was incredibly transformational for the internet, because a lot of like startups like pets.com, it's actually a good business model. But when you have such high CapEx, capital expenditure, and you can't pay as you go, like through software as a service, that flexibility in your business model, then it becomes incredibly capital intensive. And I think tokens are that new mechanism to really get off the ground these otherwise really capital intensive networks to bootstrap supply and demand. That's the hardest thing to do, right? Whenever you talk about a network, whether it's a NAT network to a physical infrastructure network, whatever, it of any kind, it's usually really intensive. And it requires you to balance, like Uber, for instance, like very few cities are actually profitable. Like if we were not in record low interest rate environment over the last 10 years, a lot of these businesses wouldn't have gotten off the ground because they required incredible amount of VC funding. And what I'm trying to say is like, I think crypto, a lot of the innovation of crypto is just that. It is like a new mechanism to get to scale, to bootstrap these businesses by turning your customers into shareholders in a very effective way. And so they're doing the marketing for you. They're buying the equipment. You're not buying the equipment. They're taking that cost and they're fronting that because they expect the reward. And as opposed to just the shareholders of this company once it goes public, like most companies are not even going public in 10 years. I think that's like a subtle mechanism, but software as a service was a huge unlock. Salesforce came around and then all of a sudden you're like, wow, like it just powered this incredible movement in the internet wave for the last like 15 years. I think people are coming to that realization, especially for Deepin. It's like, hey, this is actually or even creator networks or whatever. It's like, it's artists, both on the supply and demand side. I think people are realizing the power of, I know it sounds obvious, of like making your customers shareholders and rewarding them, mapping them out by tokenizing attention or tokenizing contributions. Is it going to sound probably ridiculous looking back? If you're a new creator and you have the option of uploading your content to a network that shares the revenue, ad revenue, 50-50 or 80-20 in your favor versus the opposite, which is YouTube. And I know people are really focused on, well, YouTube has a distribution. It's incredibly hard to displace. I'm like, yeah, but you start small, but I think the value proposition to creators, contributors writ large is really powerful for any type of network.
My thing with Deepin, I think Deepin is going to be huge. And I do think it is one of the things that brings the mainstream. I don't think it's because you become a shareholder, mainly because I just don't think most people care about that. Like,
I care about making money.
Exactly. I was going to say, it's like us in the crypto space care about maybe ownership and things. And some people want to do governance, but most people could care less. My other thing on Deepin of why I'm not sure that it's fully ready to go mainstream is because people also just don't really care about tokens, like mainstream people. So you tell them they do care about making money, but it needs to be super simple. And I just don't know that the UX of it all is quite there yet to be like, hey, add this thing to your car or add this thing to like something else you're doing your computer and all of a sudden don't make money.
Yeah. But I mean, you're old enough to remember dial-up internet.
Definitely.
Was that easy? Was that easy?
Not at all. You know what I mean? But not a lot of people did it until it went to broadband, right? Which is the moment I'm saying is like, I feel like we're still in that dial-up phase where like the use cases are there, but like, I don't think it goes into the mainstream, the super cycles kind of thing until that UX is fully fixed. But I could be wrong.
Well, look, it's a valid point. I was very critical of UX. I think a lot of times it requires you to update your thesis. Like for me, that led me to Solana. The Solana apps pre-FTX, Yankee, UX, difficult. If I were to send someone, a newcomer to crypto, and say, name me three apps to tell people to go to use, they're all in Solana. Jupiter, Tensor, and maybe some Backpack. Like, I'm biased. I'm an investor in all of them. So, you know, biased. But I invested because of that. The challenge, of course, has always been on-ramping, getting your fiat to crypto. But I think that's changing. I mean, Coinbase and Circle, they're not far from becoming large financial institutions.
100%.
And
the other thing,
it's easy to move money. You know what I mean? Like, once you interact with stablecoins and like the wallets have gone way better, like, you don't want to do wire transfers.
100%. Well, this is my debate on the UX. Is like, people always complain of the UX of crypto. And I kind of go back and forth on this because, like, if you think about the UX of moving money from one country to another, I can have a suitcase full of money and take a plane to Europe faster than I can send money to Europe, right? Which is insane in 2024.
Only less than $10,000, but yes.
Yeah, less than 10, exactly. And so, like, whenever people complain about the UX of crypto, I was like, just send money from someone to another person in the world and you'll see that this UX is actually way better. I think the problem is just the mainstream doesn't really send money to people from outside of other, like, most people in the US don't even have a passport, number one. And so, like, they live in the US, they spend in the US, and they don't need to send money elsewhere. Many of them don't travel. It's easy for me. I'm a nomad, not always nomad, but I travel around a lot. And so I'm always using different exchanges. And it is such a pain point that I could care less what the UX is. It's so obvious to me. Right. Yeah. I just think like you said, most people are lazy. And so for most people, I don't want to say most, for most Western people, money is not necessarily an issue for them. And so like the UX needs to get really, really good for them to start. You use stable coins and things like that. But definitely like the developing world, they're like, what UX problem?
No, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think at that point, the supply side probably becomes more important for in Western countries. If your local commerce, if your local favorite retail shop starts using crypto, there'll come a point where that probably becomes the hook, right? Because they might offer you better incentives for the simple reason that if you're paying with stable coins, they get that settled instantaneously. If you're swiping your Visa or American Express, they get paid in at least a week or 2 weeks time. So the working capital is just a practical business decision. A business would rather own, would rather transact in a stablecoin. It's instantaneous. It's atomic. There's no fraud. Mm-hmm. Like fail checkout is a multi-billion dollar industry. Dropped cart, false positive or false negatives, renewal for subscriptions because your credit card information has changed. Like I know Stripe is a very business, very big lucrative business. There's no need for Stripe in a world where you're transacting atomically through a stablecoin. The Stripe has come in and try to solve the patchwork clusterfuck that is a financial system, very only westernized. Crypto solves that. If we stopped innovating and we just focused on payments, then crypto's massive, way larger than what it is today. But commerce and payments with NFTs, right? Because NFTs are perfect cookies. If you're a business, of course you want someone to come in, scan a QR code. Blockchains are incredible pieces of information, a proof of time and space. And so then you layer on the deep end network that I told you that tells you exactly where you are, then all of a sudden Pokemon Go or some of these other brands are really interested because they can track location. They can, blockchains are like just better coordination mechanisms. And so therefore as a brand, as a business, you always want to coordinate, right? You attract people. The key there on the demand, on the supply side, like why payments haven't gone to scale, I think in most places is because stablecoins work. They're fantastic products. Regulation. It's just regulation.
Right.
I think most businesses would rather say, hey, listen, come to me when we have clarity. And it's sad. It's unfortunate. But I think I am very optimistic. It's like Uber faced a lot of pushback from local authorities and lobbyists, primarily the taxi industry, because you know it came and displaced their business. The reason why just you can't fight something the consumer loves and wants. So it's balancing that out. Are we at a point where Western consumers are screaming stable coins? No. And so the best we can do is just continue to build really good applications like Deepin. Like stablecoins in and of itself are not going to move the needle because to your point, most people are not moving money. They're not thinking about, you know, but when you have AI agents transacting stablecoins, when you have Deepin networks transacting stablecoins, the more and more consumer facing applications that get scale gaming or using backend in their backend stablecoins to settle this flow, it matters for more constituents. It puts pressure on politicians to actually realize this is a really novel piece of technology. We should probably regulate it in a sensible manner.
I mean, same thing would happen to the internet, right? They try to regulate it out, and then it was just so good for the consumers that you got to do it.
It's like interesting. Napster got shut down, and then Spotify came around. Yeah,
right. It's interesting though. We kind of jumped around a bit here of many different topics, but this is what's kind of interesting about crypto to me, and what I love about it is, there's not just one use case or one thing that will make it go mainstream. It's like we're hitting it from all angles. There's payments, stable coins, there's cookies with NFTs, as you just mentioned. You mentioned something about creators and how they can put their content on chain and make more revenue. There's Deepin. Like there's so many use cases that blockchain just makes the internet and the world, quite frankly, just more efficient and better. And so it's like, this is that secular trend you're talking about. Yep. We don't know which one of these trends are going to hit today. And be the next thing, but there's just so many shots at it that you might as well be in it because it is such an obvious secular trend.
Yeah.
My question though is when you look, so obviously, okay, secular trend, be in crypto. That's the number one advice there. If you're not in crypto, well, that's a bit crazy. And then we talk, let's say Deepin, for example. When you look at Deepin, you go, okay, this is probably the next big thing. It might be the thing that brings in the masses. How do you think about then investing that? I'm sure you do a lot on the private side with most of these companies. So it's probably more private than liquid. Mostly private. So maybe you can't really talk about your liquid strategy, but if you did,
Yeah. That's actually a great question. To be fair, I've spent more time in liquid markets now because private markets are getting way out of hand. They're like so hot. I mean, most funds didn't allocate last 2 years. Mm-hmm. They're scared shit. And, you know, most of them blew up or lost money. And there wasn't a lot of capital. Now they're offside and they've been sidelined. and they're trying to catch up. And so I think the time to invest in private rounds was last year. This year, I'm investing less of my capital on privates and spending more time on public, on liquid stuff. I just think there's stuff that is overlooked, falls off the top 100. You're getting it cheaper than what the private round was last raised at. The team has continued to build, continue to ship. It's a de-risked investment. Now, was it worth what it was the private round? Yeah, different question. Many times, no. But the nice thing about projects that have a token is that you can, I think they're, you can do much more diligence, right? It's farther ahead. This played out like last cycle. Some of my best investments was looking at Aave, for instance, or like synthetics and projects that are raised. Yeah, okay, large ICOs, whatever. The token collapses 98%. And as a founder, if you continue to build through really adversarial environment like that, and you're not demoralized and you've been able to retain or grow your team, then I'll hand it to you. That to me is impressive. I want to back those guys that have like forged in the fire of a bear market. It's never easy to build in crypto. In a bull market, people are screaming at you to launch a token in a bear market. You're a scammer and you've done, price goes down and it's all your fault. But, you know, I think it takes a certain level of like moral fiber to be successful. And I sympathize with founders. So I think it's really interesting to back those type of founders, right? That you know, haven't been demoralized, continue to build. And there's a lot of projects out in the public. Like 5 out of my last 6-7 deals have been like OTCs directly with the team. I go to them and say, hey, look, I want to get your token. I'll commit to a long lockup. You know, I'm comfortable holding the bag for 1 or 2 years or whatever, but I can't buy it because there's no volume on this thing. It's like, it's going to take me a year to accumulate size. Like, but I want to work with you. Like, here's the things that I want to help you with. And so, you know, if we can structure something like that, then nice. It's like a pipe. Other times I just buy a liquid token. Most privately funded things are not going to outperform something like Solana or even Ethereum.
That's my problem.
Or even Ethereum or Bitcoin. It's really hard to outperform, has been, something like Ethereum through cycle. It's just actually quite hard.
I agreed with that. I think new people coming in the space don't really realize that. They don't realize how, I don't want to say easy, but like almost easy it is to just hold the major and let it go. You can hold Bitcoin through the cycle and you'll do friggin' very well. And compared to traditional finance and traditional assets, like it's unbelievable how well you can do. Let's talk about, you mentioned Solana a bunch of times now, and you've hinted at your superiority of Solana. And I just want to talk about that thesis real quick here, because one of the questions that we put out on Twitter, or someone actually asked, was they've heard that you're big on Solana. You think it's going to outperform ETH, I guess, through this cycle. I assume it's longer, but you can comment on that. Mm-hmm. And is there anything that would make you reevaluate that thesis? Like, what, you obviously think Solana is the narrative or the next thing. Why do you think that, number one? And then would anything change that? And I guess actually, if you can comment, how do you then go invest in that? Is it just you buy Sol? Or are you going in a bunch of different projects that are built on Sol?
Yeah, levered bets on Sol, like investing in. So two things. Like, my journey in Solana is long. Like, I was an investor in multicoin, so they were investors in Solana early on. And then I started paying more attention when I was a ParaFi. I obviously bought when the foundation sold, like at a dollar or whatever. And so I think architecturally, the background of the founder, like someone like Anatoly, comes from, like, he worked at Cisco, I believe. He understands networks. Like, scaling networks is, they have the same problem scaling blockchains. Like, you have this problem where you have surges in demand and you have to balance that load somehow, and so the network doesn't break. It's like a network problem. And I think Solana, like, you hear Anatoly, one of the founders of Solana, talk over and over that. So I think his background is really well suited for that. And I think they just take a very different approach to, and a very opinionated one on, you'll hear him say time and time again, I want NASDAQ on blockchain, like real time, highest throughput, low latency network. That's their thing. Yeah. They've held to that. And does that mean it's going to serve all use cases? No. Where I think a lot of people, including myself, have been critical over time has been like this higher hardware requirements, right, to run a node. And I think it sort of is counter ethos to like decentralization and what, yada, yada. But I think it's kind of nice and sounds really cool to be able to run a light node, like with a Raspberry Pi. It's like open, accessible to everyone. And like, does that contribute to security? Probably. How many people are actually running a node in their kitchen counter? None. There's always clusters and centralization. Look at Lido. Look at Bitcoin miners. There's just a thing. Technology is centralizing. Now, the thing that I make Solana quite interesting, and I had this realization like last year, it's like, okay, well, there's actually really nice applications here. You're actually seeing real usage. Like, look at Jupiter. Look at, like, it's a delightful experience. I'm not talking about delightful within crypto. I'm talking about delightful relative to like Web 2. Like, it is actually something that I'd be proud to send someone in Web 2, a fintech investor, be like, take a look at Jupiter. Take a look at Backpack. Take a look at, you know, Tensor. It's good. There's no UX problem. Like, it's seamless. So Phantom, it's actually like easier to use in many ways. The realization for me is like when we think about like the blockchain trilemma, right? It's like security, you know, you have to make some sort of trade-off. But I actually think like, yes, there's a higher hardware requirement, but at the end of the day, if there's a ton of activity in network, that means there's going to be a lot of fees for validators. That means you're going to justify the CapEx to run the node that is more expensive. By the way, it's not that more expensive. It's like $700. It's sort of like a mute argument of like the higher hardware requirements for me, at least, is like understanding like from a P&L perspective, like if you're going to validate, yeah, of course, you're going to, like MEV is a thing in Solana, right? Now you have Jito and like, you know, you're making a bunch of money there because there's a ton of activity. It starts and ends with, can you actually have a network that has a ton of demand? Because that's not a bad problem to have. Now, Ethereum has had a ton of demand, but it just hasn't been able to scale because it's not parallelizable. It just struggles. It's very fragmented, the L1 to L2, now L3. Is Ethereum dead? Absolutely not. I still invest in Ethereum. I still have a big part of my portfolio in Ethereum. I've invested in a number of, I seeded a bunch of L2s. Like, I think it's their interesting research experience. I think they might work. Solana is not the be and end all of things. You have like other design mechanisms. You have other languages like Move that make it really interesting from like a DeFi perspective. Move as a programming language, I think, is like far superior from a DeFi use case, just like the security of it. I believe in a multi-chain world. I think generally speaking, and Solana has had a couple issues, and you've heard the team, even the team is very upfront about it. Right? They have technical debt because they have limited resources. They have to push stuff out. And you've seen those outages, right? Most recently, like dealing with spam in the network has been an issue. I think every network kind of struggles with that. It's growing pains. Most blockchains, I think, and where the most of the innovation, I think, will happen now going forward, at least in the L1 space, is like, how do you price compute? How do you price block? Like, how do you price that? The fee markets and how you price those is an area that requires and is probably worthy of a lot more innovation. And I think you're seeing some interesting experiments there. Solana and the team is very aware of that. Like, you're probably going to have an EIP 1559 type of mechanism in Solana. It's underpriced. It's kind of hard. Like, imagine you saying, okay, I'm going to build this huge highway wherever you are. Imagine it's like there's no one there. And you're forced to make a decision of how to price the toll fee. You're like, fuck, right. I don't know. Like, no one's showing up here. Like, no one, there's like no one in sight for the next city is like 1,000 kilometers away or miles away. But you're forced to make the decision of how to price the toll and the highway cost at that moment in time. It's unrealistic for you to price it efficiently. That's like basically every network is mad to make that decision. And so it's different now that you have millions of cars going through on a daily basis. Well, you have to update that. You have to change the economics, but it's not a bad problem to have. I think Solana is very focused on that. You also have a second client. So having client redundancy is incredibly important for these, you know, the uptime and the liveness of a network for it to not go down. Ethereum has multiple clients. Bitcoin has multiple clients. Solana needs to have multiple clients. There's this thing called Fire Dancers developed by the Jump team that is launched later this year. So that's also very encouraging, right? You want to have a network that is performant. If you're a builder, you want to have those assurances that it's a network that, fine, okay, great, a lot of this interest and a lot of usage and users, none of it matters if it constantly fails once it gets demand, right? So if you're all showing up to watch the stadium in the game and the stadium lights don't work, well, people are going to go to a different stadium. And so it's important to pay attention to this, right? You could have looked perhaps like last 2 weeks and seen the Solana transactions not landing and saying, God, this is awful. And I get it. It was a very bad experience. But where I tend to focus on as an early stage investor or even investing in public stuff is, again, going back to, what is the DNA of the team? One, how do they behave? How do they communicate under adversity? And how quickly are they technically competent to patch this stuff? And I think you saw a pretty Herculean effort from the Solana developer community to like patch this thing and also like be acutely aware. Name a project that has had taken it on the chin, constant criticism, and they've used that to their advantage because they've optimized fee markets. They've optimized certain things because they're aware it's not a perfect network. Whereas Ethereum is going through this kind of like, there's some fantastic builders in Ethereum, like folks like Steven and Arbitrum, like really good guy, like Justin Drake, really solid, humble, aware that they need to make a lot of, like, it's so early still. But then there's a huge contingency that it's like, we figured it out. Everything else is a scam. Really? That has never served anyone well.
Yeah. The other, I mean, Solana being the team that, you know, they took it on the chin and they just kind of battled through it is completely true. I'd say the other one is like ETH did that, right? But they did it 4 years ago, right? So they were kind of, and I guess you could say Bitcoin did it too, being the first to even start this thing off, right? which is one of those telling signs of like, this is how you know that this ecosystem is going to be one that makes it. And then the other thing I would say to add to your thing on Solana, which was you talked about there's no, or can a open source project have a moat? And a lot of people are like, well, it's going to, you know, Solana's going to be the retail chain where all the meme coins are, et cetera. And I was like, yeah, maybe. But I mean, you look at Base, it's taking off, it's getting meme coins. Yeah. But Solana does have a bit of a moat right now for Deepin, right?
Yeah, Deepin lives. I invested in this project that I'm talking about. I said, I'll invest if you like take a serious effort on moving to Solana, because Deepin lives in Solana.
Yeah, and I'm sure some of the other like newer L1s that come maybe can take that share, but yet to be seen. And like obviously they're very far off from where Solana is. So like I kind of see Solana as having a bit of a moat, but I don't know that that lasts for forever, obviously. So maybe moat is the wrong term. But anyway, I completely agree. On the east side, though, obviously you're still investing in it. So I don't think it's done with. It's still a relevant place or like
you think Solana takes it all. No, well, look, I think Sol outperforms ETH. Yes, I position myself, but I'm still investing in ETH, like in ETH projects for sure. I'm investing in like certain L2s that are very opinionated about the trade-offs that they're making. Yeah, we're going to have a centralized sequencer, but we're going to be focused on throughput. Like, okay, fine. Yeah, good. Or, hey, we're going to be very focused on this particular region or this particular use case. Like, yes, Ethereum's like, again, you got to think of probabilities, like the probability of Ethereum going to zero. Well, no, like there's still a lot of really smart devs are there. A lot of attention is there and some fantastic researchers are trying to figure this stuff out. Right. And so the modularity kind of movement is really interesting. You know, like you've basically unbundled the components of what a blockchain does. And so that's freed up a lot of capacity, a lot of ability to do really cool stuff and lower fees. And so, and perhaps higher throughput, but there are certain limitations around like single threaded EVM that I have issues and concerns with, and why I like sort of parallelized environment that I think is just, I understand that. My lizard brain sort of understands that better. I struggle with a single threaded EVM. Like it's just, there's some things that unfortunately, when you go first and you make certain architectural decisions, I don't think if you were to ask Vitalik, if he would have built the network today, he would have designed it the way that he did. It's just a virtue. As you said, we're early, we're trying stuff. There's cutting edge research on both cryptography, game theory, economic like incentives, but particularly I think blockchain design is an area where even if you ask Satoshi or Vitalik, I think they would say, yeah, we would probably make some modifications. And I think the single versus parallelized execution environment is one that I think is the biggest constraint that Ethereum faces today. And making EVM compatible and migrating to that is something that is going to be difficult.
Right. Well, speaking of being first, I don't think I've heard you speak about this much on the Empire podcast anyway, but Bitcoin is having a bit of a renaissance, right? It's coming back. And not just like Bitcoin dominance. I mean, L2s coming up, Bitcoin Runes just launched. Like there's a lot happening there. It's a weird, different world. Curious what your thoughts are on that. Are you bullish on this?
No. If you're in the space, you appreciate Bitcoin. It is the king. Right. It is the largest 100%. Network. We're sort of like, I think the Taproot upgrade, was it like 2020, late 2021, early 2022, like really has set the path. I'm saying this because people need to appreciate this didn't happen overnight. The Taproot upgrade like allowed for what you see like ordinal activity like really spike up, and then a whole interest in like L2s or even native L1s that are like trying to bring more things to do if you're a Bitcoin holder. I mean, there's just a ton of unproductive capital there. And so, yeah, like there've been like TBTC and a couple other things, but like trying to bridge your Bitcoin over to Ethereum. But no, like a core Bitcoiner is going to be like, bring me something here. I'm not going to go to another shitty blockchain, which is right. You know, like you're trading security. And I think the core Bitcoiner doesn't want to do that. And a testament, unfortunately, the whole irony of it is that they ended up like putting a lot of their Bitcoin in centralized venues like BlockFi and it blown up.
Right.
Because they didn't want to use a shitcoin network, like a shitty network like Ethereum, and instead use a centralized provider, which was like probably worse. Sad and unfortunate. But I think that speaks to the opportunity at hand. I just announced two investments, one Meso, which is built by the Thesis team, which has been in around and building around the Bitcoin ecosystem from TBTC to Lolly. And I know Matt for years. So I'm excited. They're trying to bring like an economic layer. Just kind of think of it as an L2 Bitcoin. And so I think it's a very competent team. It's one of those teams has been focused constantly on Bitcoin. And the other one is Arch Network, which is different from an L2. It's actually natively L1, kind of building like kind of like a parallel chain and then doing a lot of like through parallelization, like a lot of things there. On both instances, you have to, there is some trust assumptions that you need to like loosen up, right? The question is, who's your audience? And for a lot of these projects, I do question, and I have looked at a lot. I'm like, do you really understand the core Bitcoin holder? and how easy and accessible and also upfront are you going to be about these trade-offs? Because a lot of teams might say, well, look at ETH1, L2. Most people don't care that, you know, Optimism doesn't have fraud proofs. And basically, it's just like a multi-sig. But they love yield, and so they're going to degen into this. I'm like, I understand that's happening in Ethereum, and I understand human psychology and behavior, but appreciate the Bitcoin holder. Like, it's just a different animal. I think it's an incredible, just around, I think it's an incredible, exciting moment for Bitcoin. Finally, my biggest concern with Bitcoin has been the 95%+ of all the security budget of Bitcoin, 95% of it comes from block rewards. Like, I need to see fees. That's what supports it, right? And so I'm happy because finally miners have woken up with ordinals largely and saying, we actually make a lot of money. And Bitcoin is making a lot of money as an L1 now with fees.
Right now.
And like that's really exciting. Right now. Yeah. No, I mean, and it probably does. Like, if it does another 10X, I won't be surprised. Like, I mean, it's not sustainable, but it's encouraging.
Yeah. So I agree. My only problem with this is I feel like all the things that they're building on Bitcoin right now, which are meant for, as you said, you know, your audience, which are meant for Bitcoiners, is like, how many Bitcoiners are there really? And like, how many more are there to come? When the masses come to crypto, they're not coming in with the same mindset and like idea that the Bitcoiners that have been around since, you know, 2010 have. I think they're coming in for very different reasons. And so I just wonder, like, it's a very small audience that Runes and all this stuff is building for. And yes, people play around with it right now and it'll probably have a hype cycle. I don't know that that's what the world cares about or what a lot of people are going to care about, because I just don't think the Bitcoin religion continues to proliferate, really. I think people will hold Bitcoin and whatever. But I'm just not sure that those properties matter to a large group of people.
I think it's an excellent point. I am more excited about other stuff.
Yeah.
I'm excited because it's a very interesting question. Maybe like in a year's time, we'll revisit this and say, yeah, like you're basically saying, and I kind of agree with it. No, I definitely agree with this. Maybe not from a flows perspective, because a lot of flows might just go to the Bitcoin ETF that is constantly buying you know, Bitcoin. But from like a number of users, I mean, the UX is better in Solana, right? It's better in Ethereum than what is in Bitcoin. Like, it's a pulling teeth trying to buy, you know, runes. It's like, reminds me of the early DeFi days. I don't know. Part of me, just, I'm always very excited when I see some really killer use cases. And crypto feels real. And I've struggled to make people see that like over the last 12 years. And so finally my life becomes easier when I tell people, you just download this app, you know, Stepin, for instance, like, and of course I was a first investor, like advisor. And so, you know, I'm biased, like whatever, but Stepin was kind of the first application that people that I knew were skeptical, had no interest in crypto, reached out and say, hey, I see you on the website. You're like an investor advisor. Can I get a code? I want to use this. My friends are using it. I just went to dinner. People talking about Stepin. I want to use it. At some point, technology needs to become real for people and not just so abstract. And like investing in like a DA layer, it's just like, there's only so many handful of people get excited about it. Maybe you and I are one of them, but you know.
This is the thing for me too, is I've been telling everyone I know about crypto for forever. And I'm like, listen, there's going to be these cool apps that we're all going to use. And then the thing that just keeps coming back is meme coins. And I'm like, damn it. Like, it's almost embarrassing to try to bring these people in the space, and then this is the thing that keeps coming up, and you're like, okay, this is harder to get people to really get serious about this. Not that I hate on meme coins. I actually just bought my first meme coin the other week as our community member. So, but interested to hear, this will be our last sort of narrative or subject we'll touch on, but it kind of floated well. So I just want to hear your sort of, obviously it's the biggest thing right now and has been for a little while. So I want to hear your take on it.
I was just in a panel and Token 24 and I talk about memes, and look, I never even thought I'd be invited to a meme panel because I was very skeptical of memes in every other cycle. And it's actually, you're trying to reinvent the financial system, and then you have like a Doge that just is worth more collectively than all DeFi. And you're like, for fuck's sake, you know, like we get discounted as an industry. My concerns around meme coins back then were, it makes a mockery of the space. It's a distraction. This is why we're not taken seriously. This is why crypto will never be big. Now I actually take a more practical stance, which is, it doesn't matter what I think. And it actually showcased to people, it is pretty novel. Like, memes are, mimetic desire is like incredibly powerful. We talk about community and culture and crypto a lot. Then why don't we accept memes? It's a pure expression of a meme. It's a desire. And it's interesting because you're seeing, so I'm not skeptical now. Actually, I'm very interested in memes. I invested a lot of memes. I think they're important cultural components. They're no different than NFTs, actually. In fact, more accessible. A lot of VCs are actually skeptical of memes because all of a sudden people are not buying their high FTV, low float coins. and they're going, yeah, okay, who's going to, we talk about like people in investing in markets get hurt. I understand that. People make money, they lose money. It's true for Vegas. It's true for the stock market. It's true for crypto. And so the argument around meme coins, people lose money on meme coins, is one where it doesn't get to the nuance of it, which the most important thing is not to be opinionated about a marketplace, but to be focused on, and if you're a regulator, to be focused on markets being fair, transparent, and accessible to all, not to have an opinion on what is actually traded in these venues, unless, of course, they're causing harm. If you're funding terrorism, you're, of course, that right. You interfere. But that's the role of the regulator. And so being opinionated about what people want to trade is like saying Vegas and gambling, I think, like sports gambling and betting, sports betting has gone through this evolution. It used to be banned in many states. Now it's opening up. People take an interest in that. I mean, people at the end of the day want to live their life and have fun. Vegas, no different than the stock market, no different than memes. If memes are a mechanism to get people interested in crypto and showcase what is tokenizing culture and attention is, then by all means. Also interesting, you have a flavor now of meme coins that are acting like prediction markets. You have the Biden token, you have the Trump token. That's going to play a huge role in, like, Biden has a speech and that token's active. Markets are arbiters of truth. And meme coins, like a flavor of Trump and Biden, I would argue, are better predictors of the election than your political analyst and pundit in CNN that has no value on the line. By the way, they've been incredibly unsuccessful. Nate Silvers of the world didn't predict Trump, are not going to predict your next president. Take a look at, if you have a market that's trading billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars that represents the collective consensus on a particular candidate, that's really interesting. And so I think it showcases, Chris Dixon had an op-ed on the Financial Times or critical of meme coins. He also, I think, seems to contradict his theory that most technology, big technology, starts like a toy. I think you should take a serious look in the face and then say, okay, well, isn't that meme coins? Look, not all meme coins are created equal. People talk and are critical about, look, certain meme coins launch and they get botted, they get sniped. The team takes 40% of it, distributes a bunch of wallets. I'm like, yes, not only a problem meme coins. Be skeptical and wary. Look on chain. If you don't know, ask. But that's not a problem. The criticism a lot of times of meme coins are not inherent. Like MEV is a thing. It's unfortunate. It's a thing. There are really interesting mechanisms like pump.fun that basically allows anyone to create a meme coin. So say that we want to create a meme coin about this episode. We record it. We store the video and IPFS and, you know, the meme coin, however, represents like this Milk Road. I say something stupid in the spot. People want to meme it, whatever. They go and pump.fun. You have a bonding curve mechanism. So as opposed to launching something with really low liquidity, which is how you get these unfair distributions of meme, you have a bonding curve where, like an auction, like people like explicitly express certain interests. And so out of the gate, there's more liquidity, therefore less manipulation, therefore fair market. And I think like we should be thinking more about, okay, how can we have these more fair distributions of whatever token, whether it's a meme or not, through bonding curve mechanisms, which we know are better mechanisms for distribution, certain auctions with privacy enabled in them or whatever. Like that's a real more important fundamental question.
Right.
But I guess as a closing question would be, who do you think gets hurt the most? Like you have WorldCoin trading at like 150 billion fully diluted. And like, let's actually look at this actually as an experiment, because people bring up WorldCoin and I just think it's ridiculous. WorldCoin market cap, $1 billion. Fully diluted, it's come down, 55 billion. Look at that ratio. Like, you know what I mean? And by the way, the circulating supply is, you know, 1%. No, it's actually, no, 200 million out of 10 billion. So what's that? Over
20%, no?
No, 10 billion.
No, 2%.
2%. 2% in circulation, right? You have a massive unlock schedule of people that invested early that want to get their capital back and want to recoup principal and then lock in a return. Does retail know that or aware of that? Most of these memes, WIF or whatever, fully diluted, like fully distributed, all the tokens are in circulation. The price of that, the price of WorldCoin is not 55 billion. Because if you try to liquidate all of that, the order book does not support that.
Right.
But on the other hand, meme coins, you know, don't have this problem. Most of them are just fully distributed and they're trading. And by the way, WIF and some of these, and Dogecoin and Sheeb, like they actually represent a huge percentage of trading volume. So what I'm trying to say is I'm happy to have a debate about it. I'm happy to have a discussion about it, because a lot of times it's important to like focus and be critical of a particular topic like meme coins, because it then highlights the broader issues of crypto distribution, funding mechanisms, maybe ICOs are the solution. Maybe we should go back to that, because it's basically allowed people to like pool capital. Like, that is a huge novelty, untethered, unpooled capital markets. And when we think about regulation, which is much needed, is we should just focus on how do we make these markets more fair, more transparent, uniform the disclosures. Like, a lot of this stuff is on chain. Like, you can understand supply, you can understand the vesting contracts. Let's make sure that that's uniform and standardized. And projects that don't abide by that get penalized, or don't operate in these markets, don't get listed. Those are the real questions. That's where the nuance is. People want to trade a dog coin and that makes them happy. So be it. Who cares?
I agree.
Life's too short.
I think we're super early in what meme coins are going to be. Like, your explanation of like Geo Bowden and that as well, as like almost like a predictions market. There's so much that could come from this, and I'm not smart enough to know what that is. You mentioned with Chris Dixon how he says, you know, most things look like toys. Most like good technologies look like toys in the beginning. This is definitely that. And I still think it's very early stages in that. And who knows what gets built out from that. I think it's going to be a whole different world than most people are even imagining, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this was great. So I want to finish off with just like a question for you to just share any relevant advice for the listeners in terms of, I mean, everyone here that's listening is an investor of some sort. They obviously have a lot of their capital in crypto and they're trying to navigate this cycle or this space as best they can. And so I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you just to give the best advice you possibly can. Before you give that advice, though, also let people know where they can follow you, where they can find you if they want to learn more from you. So I'll let you share that first. And then that gives you a little bit to think about your advice. And then just the best piece of advice you can give the listeners, that would be great.
Yeah. Twitter. I'd like to keep the conversation open, accessible to everyone. And so that's the best way. And then obviously I do Empire. I let Parify. I manage my own capital now because it frees up my time to bring, and much like you, I think elevate the discourse in crypto, more education, less buy this, buy that. Just take an interest, go through this crypto journey. It's the best thing I've done in my life. Like, it forces you to question everything, and everyone should go through that process. Great. Whether you come out of that believing in any particular crypto asset, currency, great. If you don't, even that's fine too. So take the time. It pays off. Develop a process. And that would be my advice. You know, I think, I don't pretend to give advice. What worked for me may not work for you. And so I think it's very important to internalize that. And crypto, as you said, is a fascinating industry, because I believe that I am earlier today than I was in 2012. It just is. Like, you just finally see a line of sight in like how crypto really fits into solving a lot of the world's problems. Like, even with AI, like AI agents are going to use stablecoins. Like, technology is an incredibly abundant but also centralizing force. Crypto is probably our best shot to more equitably distribute value. And I think a testament to that is just really smart people coming and try to build in this space. People that don't have a need to work ever again in their life, but they appreciate that this technology is like, can really transform. And I think it's going to be one of those things where we look back and we say, people made the distinction between an internet business and a non-internet business. I think similarly, where there's like a crypto business and a non-crypto business, this is just a better, more efficient mechanism to coordinate attention and transmit value using and magnifying what the internet has allowed us to do with information. We're incredibly early. And what is most powerful about open source systems is that they really break with useless, stupid constructs like having to have a university degree, having to have money, having to look or talk in a particular way. If you're smart, there's a much higher probability for you to be discovered in an open source system. If you're contributing to these systems, by the way, no one is stopping you from going in and contributing. And you don't have to be an engineer. You can start posting on Discord channels. You can become, like, we all started from zero in crypto. And I think you did as well. And we all get a ton of help. And that's just the ethos of open source systems. Like, and if that doesn't get you excited, then I don't know what does, really. Seriously, like, it is the place where I never thought I'd leave the US. I thought the US, and probably still is today, the best country in the world, because of this idea that anyone can come in and really make it. There's a ton of opportunities, like public education. But now with the internet, like, there's all this knowledge that is free and accessible. And so you combine that with the capital markets that is crypto. If you're smart, you didn't have to go to Harvard. You don't have to be in Silicon Valley. If you have a good idea, you're going to be funded, because there's a bunch of capital that is moving. And historically, that hadn't been the case. You had to be in Silicon Valley. You had to be at the right place at the right time. Now, still important, less so. I think it matters. Now, I think the ability for people that are smart and building interesting things or thinking interesting things for them to get funded has never been easier. And that's just like super exciting. Take advantage of that.
I can agree more. 100%. The opportunity is, it's like what it was if you were, I guess, an entrepreneur in the late 90s on the internet. It's the same now, right?
But maybe an entrepreneur living in San Francisco in the right network.
Right, true.
Now,
Now it's global.
Now you don't have to necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. Well, Sani, thanks so much for joining us on Milk Road Radio. I really appreciate your time. Appreciate your insights. It's great to get someone that's such a deep thinker on this space and not just throwing out price predictions and things, but instead like really thinking through. And yeah, it's great to have you on. We'll have to get you back on again.
Absolutely.
There's always so much going on and awesome. We got to get your updates too.
I appreciate Kyle. Always happy to come back and be and laugh at how terribly wrong my predictions were in this episode. And I really enjoyed the questions and the discussions. Hopefully it was useful for your audience as well.
Awesome. I'm sure it was. All right. Well, thanks so much. And listeners, we'll see you guys in the next one.
Thank you for listening to Milk Road Radio, the easiest path to get smarter about crypto. If you like this episode, share it and hit subscribe or follow so you don't miss out on the next one. There's also a link in the description to our free 5-minute daily newsletter where we simplify crypto for you while making you laugh. And if you're willing to step up your crypto investing game, then we'll leave a link to Milk Road Pro as well, your number one resource to help you invest successfully in crypto. One final note, this podcast is for educational purposes only, and nothing we say is financial advice. Crypto is risky, so you should never invest more than you're willing to lose. Thank you, friends, and we'll see you in the next one.